Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. We're broadcast in over 140 countries and all throughout the United States. I welcome all of you. Today we have a very empowering hour. Lots of health and healing and nutrition and anti-aging. And also heads up of why you should not be having that the soft drinks that are so ubiquitous in most people's homes. Also, I'm opposed to Tamiflu. I'll tell you why. If you have Alzheimer's or you want to boost your memory, improve cognition, I'll tell you what to do. If you're pregnant, why you don't want to be around a lot of traffic. And how about all those negative thoughts? Do you want to get rid of them? Just throw them away. I'll show you the latest on that. From our environmental segment today, an American Fukushima is possible, according to William Boardman from Op-Ed News. I'll tell you about that. And also, we're now saying, gee whiz, so what if it gets a little warm? You've heard the people who are still in denial about the impact of global warming. Well, they ought to pay attention because what's happening in Sweden is really an eye-opener. I'll bring you up to date on Sweden. Also, we're asking a basic question. Why is it that Obama's top economist told him that in order to have a recovery in the economy, you're going to have to reduce private debt? I repeat, private debt, not the national debt. Why wasn't any of this discussed with us? What does it mean, reducing private debt? I'll deal with that. And the social crisis in the U.S., the figures are staggering. I'll get to that a little later on in our commentary from Andrew Damon from Global Research. Needless to say, we take on the issues that are important for those of us who are looking for solutions. Let's begin. For those of you who are recovering from any form of surgery, the latest research published in the Southern Medical Journal, done at the University of Kentucky, shows that music therapy is extremely beneficial during and after surgical procedure and can reduce pain, and you recover much faster. You're less anxious, and you recover more quickly and satisfactorily after being exposed to music, both intra and post-operation. They all also required less sedative medication and reported better satisfaction with their medical experience. Quote, music therapists have long known that music can be an effective tool to manage pain and anxiety. Our music therapists regularly use music-based interventions to help patients manage both pain and anxiety. And that was the latest on this. I remember having a retreat out in New Jersey at Lake Pacong, where I once lived. It was a beautiful environment. It was the oldest house on the lake from the early 1800s. And I built a series of decks going from the house down to the lake, about 2.5 acres. And there were a group of people who were very anxious. And specifically, I had wanted to see what would happen without any talk therapy, no psychological counseling, even though I had Dr. Donald Mullins from the Albert Ellis Center, a board-certified clinical psychologist, and I had others who were board-certified clinical psychologists. But instead, I just wanted to see what would be the power of combining nature and music. But all the people who came had been or were under treatment for various forms of depression, anxiety, mood swings. In other words, they were walking around with a dark cloud over their psyche. And what I did was simple. I selected a different theme of music each day. The first day, it was rain. And it was rain and thunderstorms, and it was rain hitting a tin roof. The next day, and also there were waterfalls in there, and the sounds of a brook. Now, these were real real sounds, because I had gone out. I was writing the music for a CD I was doing at the time on the sounds of healing, but I actually recorded these. I spent dozens and dozens of hours, for example, by the seashore at night, recording waves coming in. And then I have a tin roof on my house where I live, and I would just put my microphone, highly sensitive mic, up, and you would hear the rain hitting the tin roof. It's very relaxing. It's one of the best ways of chilling out. So I would just ask them to close their eyes and to sit on a deck, on a nice comfortable cushion or chaise lounge. Just look out at the water. This was the middle of the week, so there was no traffic on the lake. And just to feel at ease and let the music carry them to a very blissful place. Now, each day there was a different form of music. The next day it was flute. And then there was harp. And then violin. And then Gregorian chants. So each day, all day, at their leisure, they could be around aromatic flowers. For example, having lavender, honeysuckle, lilac, ginger, chrysanthemums, things that bloom. Well, chrysanthemums are exceptional. They'll bloom in the daytime, as well roses. But everything else was a night bloom, meaning at nighttime, sitting under the stars and having these wonderful aromas waft through the air, and you smell them, and it induces a sense of ease. And that was the whole idea. Dis-ease, to de-stress. And it worked. At the end of the week, on the last day, I filmed the people, only then, talking about what did this week mean for them. And without exception, they had not used their tranquilizers or medications. They, even though I had there a psychologist and therapist to help them if they chose it, none required. And people then use that as a basis of realizing that all of us are exposed to multiple stressors every day. And some people, depending upon the circumstance in their life, have a far greater burden of stressors than others. But we are all exposed to some stress. How we deal with the stress is the key. So I simply said, when the stress comes, if you cannot change the circumstances of your stress, and frequently we can't, then change how you're going to respond to it. And let music help you in that process. It worked. Now, we did follow-up sessions for the next 12 months, meeting once a month in the city. At least 90% of the people continued to respond favorably, and by the end of the year, almost all were out of therapy completely and realizing this didn't have to do whether they were abused as a child or neglected or disempowered. It had to do with the choices they can make in this moment. And that, again, tied into the concept that everything in life is an exchange of energy. If I choose in this moment to exchange anger, negativity, resentment, jealousy, rage, envy, for something I can connect to that is positive, life-affirming, gentle, joyful, passionate, creative, blissful, that's an exchange of energy. And that's what we don't use. We don't empower ourselves enough. Last night I had a program. I'm sure some of you tried to listen and couldn't. We had a technical glitch. And as a result, we were not able to broadcast live. The feed wasn't going out, but we did record it. And now it's up on our Progressive Commentary Hour. The first two guests, Dr. Richard Wolff, a leading economist, and I discussed the consequences of austerity. And if you've never heard the Progressive Commentary Hour, it's the most downloaded program on radio that I'm aware of anywhere. Tens of thousands of people download it on a Monday night, for example. And most of the people listen over the night, and I take a very serious topic that is not being addressed by the mainstream or alternative media, and I get the best minds I can to discuss it. And I had several people on it. Catherine Phipps was on it, for example, giving a different perspective. She is a very big believer, as am I, that don't empower the problem. There comes time when you have to let go of the problem. You have to realize that nothing's going to change. Nothing. If you continue to trust the same people who got us into the problem to get us out, for those corporations and those media to tell us the truth and do right by us, they're not going to. So continuing to be angry at them only disempowers you. I believe you have to focus upon solutions. And for that, it's individual. And so we had a lot of differences of opinion, but I really value Professor Wolf's insights because he was looking at it as a polemic and capitalism in and of itself being the problem. And I don't see that in and of itself being the problem. I see greed, which can happen whether you're communist, socialist, Marxist, Christian, atheist, Jew, Gentile, doesn't matter. Human weaknesses are unique to individuals who then more often than not associate with other people who share the same kind of weaknesses or beliefs. And then they come with some consensus. And the fact that you have consensus doesn't mean that you're any more right in your consensus. You can be consensus and wrong, i.e. the signers of the Declaration of Independence refusing to give women the same rights, African-Americans or other minorities the same rights as the gentried landowners. They had a consensus, but they were wrong. History shows they were wrong. But that's how we work today. We look for what is a consensus, and we look for where there's power, and we look for codifying the power. And then that power becomes official power. And once there's official power, then everything you do with that, you're exchanging the energy that could come from truth, individualism, your own experiences, your own feelings, your own reality, your own intuition, and you throw all that overboard to connect with something that can be absolutely wrong. It can be not just wrong, but criminally wrong, like everything currently going on in Washington. In any case, it still all comes back to you. You, the person. What are you going to do today? You have an exchange. You're going to eat something good or bad. Now, how you justify making a wrong choice should not confuse you that it's still going to have a bad outcome. It's just when. It's not will you blow your brains up playing Russian roulette. If you keep playing in time, you'll blow your brains out. We just don't think that today's French fry or hot dog or hamburger or a cup of coffee or soda or sugar or high fructose corn syrup or voting Democrat or Republican will have a negative outcome. It's all bad to the bone. It's just when. It's an exchange of energy. But look at what happens if you did the right thing. If you vote from real conscience, based upon being informed, choosing to see what's there instead of being deceived, self-deception, and intentional, conditional deception of believing in people who shouldn't be believed in and doing things you know you shouldn't do. And then one day you wake up and you have a heart attack, a stroke, you're broke, you're in a bad relationship, you're living in the wrong environment, and you don't know who your kids are. Well, hello, it was inevitable. So when you put music into your life and you intentionally choose something that will relax you, that will allow you to harmonize and exchange your stress, let that go and exchange for something pleasant. Then they take it into the hospital room. And the first to do this, by the way, were dentists. And they started playing relaxing music in dentist offices. And in fact, almost 30 years ago, I suggested to my dentist to use the same therapy, and he began to do that. And then later, others did it. And then one day, people forget where all this came from. They're just using music. Well, not enough people use music in surgical procedures, but I'm just saying they should, because a study showed it worked. It's unfortunate, once again, we have to wait for scientific validation to support reality. It's as if reality only exists once it's been independently scientifically verified. What a terrible thought that is for the human condition today. But that is unfortunately the official reality we're living with. And here's a reality for you, for all the men in this audience. You are all, to a person, as am I, susceptible to prostate cancer. What causes prostate cancer? Well, repeated inflammatory assaults. What can that be? Well, the very things you eat and drink every day. But what if you like those things? Well, you can continue to like them, but it's not going to change the fact that liking something doesn't make it any healthier. Last night, as I was working on editing our new film coming out next week, I was watching this food channel, and they had the Iowa County Fair. And they were, the biggest treats there are everything deep fried. They were deep frying butter, an entire stick of butter, basted in white flour and sugar, and then deep fried. Now, mind you, if you're looking at about 8 ounces of butter, that alone is enough to cause a heart attack by itself. If you were, and I've actually done this, by the way, many times. I have taken the blood of an individual before a meal that was high in fat and animal proteins, and a meal that was high in vegetables and fruits, and a meal that was high in juice, and then you take it afterwards. And you'll see that when you have the juice, especially a green juice, you'll see that the blood becomes redder. There's more oxygen. You see that the red blood cells are more spaced, so they're not clumping together. But the moment you have that cheeseburger or that fat or a glass of milk or a milkshake, I use all kinds of combinations, you'll see a clumping. In fact, the blood is all streaked with these little strings, as if someone put a shoelace into a milkshake, and the shoelace is white, and the milkshake is kind of a dark red, because as you have a poor diet and as you have a lot of animal proteins, your blood is very toxic, and that's where your cells clump, and that clumping can cause a stroke. So I'm looking at these people eating deep-fried butter sticks, then corn dogs, which is a hot dog that's battered and then deep-fried, then deep-fried candy bars. You're looking at 1,000 calories in these, but also it's all trans fats, saturated fats, arachidonic acid. And I didn't see a single one of these people were healthy. There wasn't a single healthy thing served. Everything's deep fried. Well, now what happens is one day people just expect that their food has to be supersized, deep fried. And then if you're a man, every single time you do that, you're contributing to inflammation, but a lot of inflammation. And the longer that's in your body, the more inflammation you have. And the more inflammation, the more it attacks your prostate. And then at a certain point, the body tips. Just like global warming, acidification of the oceans, the loss of our coral reef, the drying out of our tundras, allowing more greenhouse gases to be released. You tip, and then you can't get it back again. And once you tip it, then you go into, not only are your cells inflamed, now they're being altered. The DNA is altered, and that's where you come up with your prostate cancer. Quote from two major studies, and this was in the Agency of France Press, from a Swedish study from Lund University, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Quote, men who drink one normal-sized soft drink per day are at a greater risk of getting more aggressive forms of prostate cancer. Quote, among the men who drank a lot of soft drinks or other drinks with added sugar, we saw an increased risk of prostate cancer of around 40%, end quote. And they studied 8,000 men, 45 to 73. Now, you're only talking about 11 fluid ounces. That's very small. That's a little over a cup. And yet you increase with just that little tiny amount, 40% aggressive prostate cancer? What if you drank more than that? You're just going to increase your rate of prostate cancer. And yet, when was the last time any man, anywhere in the United States, under any medical doctor's care, was told, by the way, you know, that coffee you're drinking, highly anabolic, bad for cancer. That soft drink, highly anabolic and highly acidic and phosphoric acid and the wrong pH and pro-inflammatory cytokines, bad for prostate cancer. How about none? This is from the British Medical Journal. The latest correspondence is posted online today as part of the British Medical Journal's Open Data campaign aimed at persuading Roche to honor the promise it made almost 3 years ago to make key Tamiflu trial data available for independent scrutiny. And last week, Donald McLean, life cycle leader for Tamiflu, wrote to Professor Chris Del Mar in his capacity as coordinating editor of the Cochrane Acute Respiratory Infectious Group concerning, quote, our data on Tamiflu. Now, here's what this says in just lay language. You've seen the ads on television about getting your flu shot and it will protect you, especially senior citizens and children, those who are always told to get it. Well, in point of fact, it doesn't. That's not what the actual data shows. But when asked for the actual data, the raw data, by this great group of independent researchers, the Cochrane group, they haven't been given it. So let's get this straight so we understand this. We're all told to get the flu shot. In some cases, you have no choice. It's mandatory. You must get a flu shot. But then when we're asked, can we see the actual safety data? Can we see the efficacy data? We're told, no. Well, how can you not give us data if there are serious questions about its safety and efficacy? Because independent studies have shown that it does not protect senior citizens, but it compromises their immune system, and it actually doesn't help children either. So we don't find their safety and efficacy, and we find it's dangerous, and you're keeping all your data secret? And the answer is yes. So now at least the British Medical Journal has joined in the discussion. If you have any form of brain fatigue, if you're suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's, new report from the Radiological Society of North America, as just reported this week at their meeting, done at the University of California research, shows the following. An active lifestyle helps preserve gray matter in the brains of older adults and could reduce the burden of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. More than 35 million people worldwide are living with the disease Alzheimer's. By the way, probably 10 times that amount suffer from dementia. So getting people out there to exercise, you bet. But I'll tell you something even better. How about caloric restriction? Just eating the number of calories from high-quality foods that your body needs. Why is that important? Because lifestyle factors, I mean, simple things, gardening, a bicycling, dancing, a riding and exercise cycle, all of those, when looked upon through magnetic resonating imaging, their MRI, and a technique called voxel-based morphometry to model the relationship between energy output and gray matter, quote, voxel-based morphometry is an advanced method that allows a computer to analyze an MRI image and build a mathematical model that helps us to understand the relationship between active lifestyle and gray matter volume, and they were able to do it. So that's very important. Now, when you restrict your calories, like not eating all that bad food and deep fried food, then you're going to have more gray matter in the frontal and temporal and parietal lobes, including the hippocampus and the posterior cingulate and the basal ganglia. And all that means you're going to have less dementia. So that's good. And finally, exposure to traffic pollution in pregnancy in the first year of life, not good. It's associated with autism. This is from the Journal of the American Medical Association and the archive and its archives. Quote, exposure to traffic-related air pollution, particulate matter and nitrogen dioxide during pregnancy and during the first year of a child's life appears to be associated with an increased risk of autism. So, you've heard me mention many times that we have a lot of people listening right now who are driving cabs. And both in Washington, D.C., listening right now over WPFW, in Los Angeles, KPFK, and WBAI in New York. A lot of, and of course, some are using the telephone, which you can now listen to Progressive Radio Network anywhere at any time, just on a telephone in North America and Canada. That number, by the way, is 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. In any case, by the way, last night, had you called that number, you could have heard the show live, even though you couldn't have gotten over the internet. That's how cool that number is. Tens of thousands are using that. In any case, I've asked you to protect yourself. First, sit on a magnetic cushion. That will protect your kidneys that are getting a lot of excess movement during the day. Also, you want to be able to flex your feet. And that's why if you're wearing sandals or some comfortable type of shoe where you actually get range of motion, because by not moving your feet and being in a car, your leg is going out at a right angle and then down at the knee. And that means that in that bending, you're bending your veins, you're bending your arteries, and that is where you can end up with thrombosis or a clot. Also, you want to make sure you're taking extra vitamin E, extra vitamin C, extra calcium, magnesium, and then wear a little, anyone you want to get out there, a little ionic air filter around your head, because it creates about a 12 to 16 inch pollution barrier. And I'm suggesting pregnant women do the same thing, because that being in a car, living near a highway, you're going to be breathing in particulate matter. In the house, you can have a really good quality air filter that will get the particulate matter out. In the car, if you have a ionizer around the head, the neck, people won't see it. It's only the size of a battery, but it protects you. I also mentioned I would address this before we go to our break, and I will. This is from Science Daily. This was done at Ohio State University, and here's what it says. I thought it was very interesting. Bothered by negative, unwanted thoughts? Just throw them away. Quote, if you want to get rid of unwanted, negative thoughts, Try ripping them up and tossing them in the trash. In a new study, researchers found that when people wrote down their thoughts on a piece of paper and then threw the paper away, they mentally discarded the thoughts as well. On the other hand, people who are more likely to use their thoughts when making judgments, if they first wrote them down on a piece of paper and tucked the paper in a pocket to protect it. Quote, however, you tag your thoughts as trash or as worthy of protection seems to make a difference in how you use those thoughts, said the author of the study. Some types of psychological therapy use variations of this concept by trying to get patients to discard their negative thoughts. But the doctor in here said that if it's the first study he is aware of that has validated that approach. But at some level, it can sound silly, but we found that it really works. By physically throwing away or protecting your thoughts, you influence how you end up using those thoughts. Merely imaging engages in these actions has no effect. So we did this a long time ago, and this was published in Psychological Sciences Journal. We had a group of people spend 2 weeks at a detox. In fact, I was just looking at the photographs of this early this morning. I found a box that I didn't know was in storage, and we were clearing out the storage because I had some books I was going to send out as gifts to some of the people in the audience. And I opened up a box, and there were all these old photographs. So I'm going to post them because I think it'd be fun for people to see what they look like 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago at different retreats and the environment, what they were doing. And in one retreat, it dealt with just journal writing. That's all it was. And it was people who were highly stressed. And what I did was simple. I simply asked, what are you stressed at? What are you angry about? What resentments are you holding? Then write out what it was that bothered you, but recreate it as best you can, as accurately as you can. And then, most importantly, and here's the difference, how did that experience impact your choices in life. In other words, because of that incident or incidents that you felt bad about, what did you do after that to compensate? And almost always, we either over or under compensate. We don't let something that bad happens to us in life simply go away. We don't forget it. What we do is we hide it. We try not to think about it, but it doesn't work. It's still there. It's like an undetonated mine waiting for someone to step on. So I thought, let's just work with it. Now, string it. Let's just say that you had someone who abused you or took advantage of you in some way. How did it impact you? What were your responses then? If this person were sitting across from you today, write out now what you would say to them. You know, Charlie, I trusted you in our business working together. You're my friend from high school. And I later turn out that you were stealing from me. But whatever it is, you just write it all out. But get it all out, every single thing. And you know, Charlie, because of you betraying me, I couldn't trust anyone after that. And then you write everything out that you did after that, every subsequent action that came from that original abuse. And then you have it all there. And you look at it, and you read it. And then you say, but it's time now to forgive this. And you throw it away, and you let it go, or you burn it. But you've written it all out, and how the person impacted you, or the event impacted you, what you did because of that, how you've impacted other people. Because a lot of people are just mean and can't be trusted and are vile and never take responsibility for any of their actions. It's because they're merely overcompensating for what happened to them earlier in life. Well, it's not fair to you. You're not the one who said or did anything earlier in their life, but you're the victim today because they never let go of that energy. And anything you can't let go of, you become. And so good people do bad things and smart people do stupid things every day of their lives. So that study is the first to show, gee whiz, you can let this go, and it doesn't come back. But if you can't let something go, you hold on to it. And when you hold on to it, it just keeps recycling. How many times in your mind have you thought about a problem, and you just keep replaying it over and over and over again? It's not going to change anything. So that was a good study. I'm glad that I was able to share that with you. Now, here's an issue. This is from Washington Blog Global Research. It's short. Top economists told Obama that economic recovery required a reduction in private debt, but Obama and his economic team chose the big banks instead of the people. We've extensively documented that too much private household debt is killing our economy. While Ben Bernanke and other economists who are running our economic policy literally believe that the amount of private debt that you and I each hold doesn't matter, and it isn't even important to quantify. Economists at the Central Bank, the Bank of International Settlements, and many other leading economists say that high levels of private debt create a tremendous drag on the economy. And Obama cannot plead ignorance. A number of economists privately told Obama that his recovery policies were weak, and one key area, they didn't do enough to address the mountain of homeowner debt. The Washington Post reported yesterday, quote, 1 year and 1 month before President Obama won re-election, he invited seven of the world's top economists to a private meeting in the Oval Office to hear their advice on what to do to fix the ailing economy. Quote, I'm not asking you to consider the political feasibility of things, he told them, but rather the truth. There was a former Federal Reserve Vice Chairman, a Nobel laureate, one of the world's foremost experts on financial crisis, and chief economist of the International Monetary Fund among them. Nearly all said Obama should introduce a much bigger plan to forgive part of the mortgage debt owed by millions of homeowners who were underwater on their problems. The Obama administration, however, pooh-hooed the need to reduce homeowner debt. The meeting highlighted what today is the biggest disagreement between some of the world's top economists and the Obama administration. Now, here are my thoughts on this, and then I'm going to open this up for your talk back and your calls. Over 2 years ago, I wrote out a 40-point populist recovery plan. Let me give my thoughts for a moment on this. Here's what should be done now. A, no more quantitative easing for any banks or corporations. Instead, set aside $10 trillion at zero interest for qualified small businesses, and the qualification will not be determined by any of the inept, corrupt bureaucrats at the Small Business Administration or any other governmental agency, but instead will come from local business-backed roundtables in communities where people who know each other and know what a community needs and what it can support determine the qualification. You allow people to borrow up to $5 million. That will restart existing businesses, allow businesses that are succeeding but barely to sustain, and allow businesses that are good and feasible but have been hit by mounting debt to recover. You allow new businesses to be formed, and the majority of people working in the United States, the vast majority, work for private entrepreneurs, private small business people. The key is that for every person they hire, they must pay that person a living wage with health benefits, two people per $1 million. That would give you 10 million new jobs where people actually are making a living and can have savings and can then use that money to benefit themselves, their families, and the society they're in. Secondly, have one flat tax for all corporations. Make it reasonable. Let's say 15%. No deductions. Eliminate the IRS completely. Right now, if we did that, we would bring in almost an additional $1 trillion. Put a tax, a reasonable tax, an 8% sales tax on all transactions of a financial nature, including algorithm trades. That would bring in almost $1 trillion. Make it against the law for trading in any commodity essential life. Hence, nobody could any longer manipulate the price of water, oil, food, or currencies. Then give a 2-to-1 tax write-off to charities who would give that to businesses who de-ghettoize America by going in and not being able to genderfy and hence profit from a deal, but rather to change over the nature of inner cities to rehabilitate them by bringing back into the inner city new growth, new development, schools, counseling, therapies, arts and culture, thematic parks, all within a given community, all based upon business seeking this is a better way of helping society than just giving it in a tax. That would help tremendously. Forgiving all interest payments on all mortgages. Zero. Bringing all mortgages down to the existing value of the property. Hence, nobody would lose their home. Forgiving all student interest on all students' debt. Then allowing the student to be able to go through a structured bankruptcy if that is required for that person who cannot find work. And instead, right now, the student is given compounded interest, indenturing themselves, and then their parents or grandparents who co-signed on the loan, and even taking away grandparents' Social Security as a part of that payment system. Barack Obama could do this. They could also offer what was done a couple hundred years ago, 40 acres and a mule, 100 acres and no taxes of any kind, and organic seed and equipment given to small farmers, providing that they stay on the land and farm it organically and sustainably for at least 10 years, and 25% of everything they grow goes to local food banks for free as a give back to society. That would allow between 5 and 10 million Americans to move back to the land. Then to spend the government's money, the people's money, to recreate new infrastructure to protect us from the inevitable calamities that are coming. And then to start to reposit the idea that we should continue to live by the oceans that are unsustainable in completely arid areas, in fire areas, tornado areas, and start an honest dialogue with the American people on a weekly basis by bringing in independent scientists who are experts in real climate to say, here's the likely outcome if you stay in where you're at, so people can understand the truth and then choose to move in a reasonable and timely way to more sustainable areas of America. If we did that, we wouldn't have a problem in the future. Also, they should forgive all debt from any country that the International Monetary and the World Bank has created structural adjustment, including forgiving all the debt in Greece and Spain, because austerity does nothing to rejuvenate a society or to help it. All it does is guarantee that the people are so broken that they have no money left, they are dumpster diving, they are impoverished, and then you come in and privatize their resources. It is a completely wrong-headed approach that this administration, the last administration, that all administrations have taken. It's time that we have a true and authentic populist approach. Those are my thoughts. I stand behind them. Your turn. It's talkback time, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. Our phones are open. Your chance to call in and share your thoughts, your point of view, your insights and comments. 888-874-4888. Now, to a couple other issues. By the way, this is from Andrea Damon from Global Research. The social crisis in the United States, the figures are staggering. This is just to accent why everything they're doing now will not work. Quote, the number of Americans receiving food stamps reached a new record in August, 47.1 million. That's according to the Department of Agriculture. The average monthly food benefit per person is $130 or $4.33 a day, less than the price of an expensive coffee in Lower Manhattan. Yet a bill now being debated on the floor of the U.S. Senate would slash billions from the program over 10 years, throwing an untold number of children, elderly, and disabled people into poverty. There are already some 50 million food insecure people in the United States and 17 million hungry children in the United States. The official poverty rate is at 49 million, but there are another 49 million people who are also right at the poverty level. That's one-third of the American population. And by a new measure, California had a poverty rate of 23.5%, nearly one in every four residents in the nation's wealthiest, most populous state is poor. California, home to Hollywood and Silicon Valley, as well as the garment sweatshops and the migrant farm labor camps, has one of the highest levels of income inequality in the U.S. And the mean income in the United States dropped again. It's been dropping nonstop. So the word poverty virtually never appears in the speeches or comments of President Barack Obama, elected the highest office in a country where half the population is poor or nearly poor. The Obama administration epitomized the callousness of the financial aristocracy and its political servants. Those are a couple other thoughts. Now, let's go to the environmental segment, and as soon as your calls come in, I'd be happy to address them. This is a very important study from Sweden, and from the University of Gothenburg. Quote, drained wetlands give off the same amount of greenhouse gases as all of the industry. I'll quote this. Drained wetlands in Sweden account for the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions as Swedish industry. This is shown by a summary of research from University of Gothenburg and the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences. Forest and agricultural fields on drained previous wetlands make up 10% of Sweden's surface area, When these wetlands are drained, they become a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions. Quote, we note that drained wetlands, which have been forested or used for agriculture purposes, are a significant potential source of greenhouse gases of a magnitude that is at least comparable with the industry sector greenhouse gas emissions in Sweden. Now, what's that mean in lay language? You've heard me mention many times that when the sun gets hotter and the glaciers melt and the ice caps melt, and the snow melts, then that means that the tundra in vast areas of Russia and through Sweden and Switzerland and Norway and Finland and Canada and Alaska, the ground falls. And when that ground falls, the methane gas that's been trapped for tens of thousands of years underneath, it comes out. And that gas coming out is equal to all of the other causes in the industrial sector of civilization, meaning all the factories, and yet you don't hear a word about that. Another reason that they don't talk about that. If they did, you would see that they are going to have to acknowledge that we have a real serious problem. Let's say hello to Rudy from Montreal. Hi, Rudy.
Hello, Gary. It's really nice speaking to you. I just listened to you about a month now, and I'm really quite impressed about your honesty and knowledge. I was wondering if you have ever heard of the Keshe Foundation. It's non-profit, non-religious, but they're aiming to bring with scientific knowledge and technologies aiming to conquer problems like famine, water shortage, and electrical power, and travel in deep space. By going into plasmas and taking out what it is they need generators and producing water, food in the form of like carbon dioxide at, I believe it's a gel if I'm not mistaken, and also energy and heat and so on. Have you ever heard of this Keshe Foundation?
Yes, I have, and I am familiar with the research. What we have to understand is that the research is just research at this time, much like the Japanese are now coming up with a train that will run off a magnetic energy that will run 304 miles an hour, and because it doesn't have wheels, it will not have the noise, and it won't have the friction, and it'll be silent. And they're intending to have this ready for 1,000 people per train in the near future, the next few years. The research is exciting. It is completely plausible. And now they just have to come up with working models. Once we get to the area of working models and they're testing it, then I'll bring you up to date on it. Now, thank you for bringing that to our attention, Rudy. In the studio, and I'll take more calls here at 888-874-4888. Anything you'd like to talk about, please feel free to do so. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting and video streaming from our studio in New York City. And joining me in studio just now is Luann Panessi with your emails. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have to tell you, I have never understood the history of the Depression as well as I did today and the cycles of how we try and correct our ailing economies. That was great. I wanted to revisit the email that I brought up yesterday, if you could. About this woman who realized that she was living a very superficial, materialistic life with a husband who she kind of broke away and spent some time with herself, and she realized that she couldn't recall a single spiritual thing that she had done in her life. And she had 10 notepads of reviewing her life. And she says, I realized all of my friends in my marriage are based on illusions. We mastered the idea that as long as we were successful and accumulated wealth and positions of power, that was enough. Now I know that that's absolutely nothing. And she feels empty and her soul aches for something authentic. And she says, any help you can give at this moment would be important.
It was just before Bill Clinton was really into his high campaign. Gary came to New York. He had been the governor of Arkansas, and before that he had been the attorney general. And one of my friends, who was a couple, a prominent Democrat couple, invited me to private funding that they were going to have. All the people at that funding were respected in their fields. They all had three things in common. They were extremely successful financially. They had good reputations for being good Democrats. And they were all considered the ideals of liberal values. And therefore, anyone that they were going to support clearly would have represented the same. Young, idealistic couple, Hillary and Bill Clinton. And yet I knew a lot about the Clintons because I'd been doing some research, and I was not happy with what I had seen. And I'd broadcast that prior to him even thinking about running for president. But I knew he likely would run for president because he was also on the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Bilderberg Group, which any, if you mention those, anyone would say, oh, well, that's all conspiracy. Well, no, these are real groups, right? And look at who they choose. And I've said a long time, it's just nobody ever wanted to pay attention to what I was saying. In America, if you're ever going to be very powerful in a position where you're a policymaker, not an opinion leader, you can be a celebrity and, you know, you can be liked and or likable or not. But when you're a politician or you're someone who's going to head a major industry, you have to be selected always, no exceptions, before you're elected. It's just that we don't like to acknowledge that. We don't like to believe that there's not a real and authentic process that you go through. And as a result, we get duped all the time. Now, mind you, there's a big difference between, and I said to my friends that evening and then later on that weekend, I said, you know, there's a big difference between being a corporate liberal and a real leftist. None of your friends are leftists. No one you know or will associate with is leftist. It is the leftists who have the ideals. And by the way, I could say the same thing on the right. You know, the conservatives, the Sean Hannity and these others, you know, the nationalistic fervor they have, and America, every soldier is always a hero. These are corporate conservatives. They pride family values and national traditions. The founding fathers want small government and lots of private opportunity. Yeah, then you start looking at the hypocrisy, and they're not at all real Republicans. You know, and just like almost all the Democrats are not leftists. They may call themselves liberal, but Barack Obama doesn't have a leftist bone in his body. But he is a corporate Democrat, just like Clinton was, and just like my friends were. Now take a look at, step away from that. And look at people who had this woman who's in a successful marriage with someone on Wall Street. She says she worked on Wall Street. That was from last night. And they had everything. You know, if you're successful on Wall Street, you'll have the big apartment on Fifth Avenue or Park Avenue. You'll have the mandatory that you have a place in the Hamptons, not just any place. You have to have a very expensive place. You have to have a boat, not just any boat. You have to have a boat bigger than other people's boats. And you have to be on the social scene in West Palm Beach in the wintertime and go up to Cape May or other places in the summer, Cape Cod. You have to show that you are a value. But your value comes through the image that you manufacture. So you can't just wear normal clothing. You can't go to a normal restaurant. You can't just go out and go to a movie. You have to have your publicist call Page Six and other places and say, this person's going to show up at this place. As if by you eating at a place, it makes it a more special place that we all should covet to be there. It's just food. It's just people. Why would it be important for me to decide where I'm going to go eat or what movie I'm going to go see or I'm going to go vacation because of what someone who's famous does? But that's all based upon the substance of what Diane Vierlin in the 1960s, 50s, 60s, 70s showed was substance is style. Meaning that your style creates your substance. I was at a lot of her parties. I had lots of conversations with her and others. There were authentic people of substance, and there were an awful lot of people who had no substance, just pure style. And those are the ones everyone was interested in. The most famous models and actors, if you get them aside and take away their script and their art director and their makeup, they couldn't talk. You know, they wouldn't know conjugating a verb from not. It was all substance. And that's why they were terrified. Part of them was always terrified. They'd wake up one day and the public would realize there's just a real person here. There's no perfect person, just a real person. So what became real became anathema. We didn't want to recognize what made us human, our spiritual value, our love of life, our appreciation and respect for other people, our compassion, our warmth, our empathy, our selflessness. That was a no-starter and has been a no-starter in corporate America, in social circles, even the whole fraud of our social philanthropy. Follow that money back and you're always going to see it goes to a selective self-circle. The people that continue to use it for themselves, like another war on AIDS, another march on breast cancer, nothing ever gets done. But don't look at the reality of results. Only look at the banality of effort. You get your name in the paper for the effort to check you right and where you show up. No one sees whether or not any of it actually mattered. So when a woman wakes up one day and realizes that she is empty, good for her. Because that is the first honest day she's probably had in her life. Now she is free of any pretense that anything other than an authentic life has substance. So now she should only make an exchange of energy that nothing goes into her mind, her actions, her attitude, her body, unless it is authentic and honoring her spiritual self. No more junk food, no more fancy food that's junk food, no more fancy parties of non-substantive people. Just be human. Ground yourself in what it means to be a human being. Be around other real human beings. And then you understand what your life should be. And everything else you created up to that point is a candy cotton dream. Hope that answers the question. I'm looking at our clock. For those of you listening to our land-based program, we're out of time. For those of you who would like to continue, and I'm going to take some more calls, you can go to the telephone and listen at 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Let's say hello to Ed from New Jersey. Hi, Ed.
Well, good afternoon, Gary. How are you and Luann?
Great, thank you.
Oh, you know, I just wanted to comment because you just hit on something based on Luann's comment about her, the email received. And, you know, I work overnight by myself predominantly in a hospital setting. And over the last year or two, I've been, you know, listening to your archive shows as well as other hosts on PRN. And I found that, you know, interestingly enough, it helped me to do what you were just talking about, get more in touch with myself rather than the outside influences, which I find, you know, I'm able to peel back more and more and get in touch with myself. Just like you talk about all the time. And just like that email that Luann had stated, you know, I'm starting to see more and more that, you know, people in my everyday life just seem so empty. And they just maybe are more out of touch with themselves than they realize. But because I work overnight by myself, I realize that once people start coming in, it sort of overrides your ability to stay in touch with yourself because the normal chatter occurs and it just gets, you know, lost in that activity thrust upon by the majority of, you know, the people that are populating most workplaces because I've had a habit to work in many different environments. And I think that that's really true what you're talking about, that people need to return to that spiritual side and reach a little bit deeper and just try to peel off all those things that have been attached to us over the years, which are leaving people with an emptiness.
Ed,
I'm seeing it every day.
I appreciate these insights, Ed. Did you have a chance to listen to the debate that I had last night with the union steward?
You know, last night I listened to the one where you had the three guests on about the economy. I think it was about two nights ago. It was on the archives.
Okay, that's a different one. Listen to the archive. Last night, the last guest is a union steward, and he came out with the suggestions, you know, what we have to, but it was all pro-union. So I simply offered some challenges, politely, that how is it that all the unions in the United States, none of them found fit to vote for a third-party candidate like Jill Stein or Rocky Anderson or Gary Johnson that would have supported their pro-union positions, that would have rejected the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is the most heinous and ill-conceived treaty in American history. It will virtually destroy all unions. And also, why haven't they challenged the union membership to be more aware of how corrupt their own leadership is. I find almost all union leadership to be aligned with the power base, and that corrupts them, even if they don't like to think themselves of corrupt. And I said, and when was the last time you and all the other unions got together to protest home foreclosures? Is it worthwhile to protest about 18 million hungry children? Or $1 trillion in student debt, and those students could go to prison, private prisons, if they don't pay their debt. I haven't seen a single protest. All I see is unions protesting when there's something engaging their collective bargaining. So I consider that the unions are now not the solution, and yet I'm pro-union. I'm just against everything they stand for in its current manifestation, because they all voted for Obama, who is utterly and completely corrupt, and we all know it. And I said, so address this. When you supported Obama through your union, are you also supporting the destruction of 1,500,000 innocent civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan? Because that's how many died. 6 million have become homeless. The complete destruction of their environment, depleted uranium. Detention, continuing with the right to assassinate. 1,500 people have been assassinated under his provisions. Is this what you're about? Carrying on a budget that continues the military-industrial defense budget being $1.4 trillion, and yet the minimum wage has not been raised? And he said, some of that I agree with, but, you know, maybe we could reform. And I said, I'm against all reform. I don't believe in reform. I don't believe in reforming anything. If it's broken, get rid of it and start over. Because, no, Gary, I totally disagree with you, he said. I said, fine. He said, no, we have to have a mass movement. I said, and exactly who's the mass movement? 60 million registered voters did not vote. 1.5 million voted for independent people. But you had all these other tens of millions who voted for the wrong people. These are the people that shop at Walmart, even if their job was taken by a Walmart outsourced company in China. These are people that will eat themselves into oblivion, take tranquilizers, drug their kids, won't complain when their home is foreclosed on, nor look at to help their neighbor when it's being foreclosed on. Won't look at the trash on television as if it's not, unless it's anything other than what it is, a form of legalized pornography. So which of these people in this mass of absolute dysfunction are you expecting to be the new enlightenment? Show me the Immanuel Kant. Show me the Spinoza. Show me the Thoreau. Show me the Montaigne in that group of masses. This mass of Americans are dysfunctional, selfish, self-obsessed, and are absolutely empowering the 1%. So in my world, the mass of Americans are the 1%. They are the complete enablers, because they keep their money in the banks of the companies that are closing on their homes. That's a Stockholm syndrome. These are the people who know about globalization and yet will go down and eat at a McDonald's. These are the people who will buy something at Christmas they don't need and trample over someone and kill a guard, security guard, on Black Friday and not think twice, because they got to get something that nobody wants. It's going to be junk and they can't afford it, and buy it on a credit card as if that's going to somehow, buying love, buying your kid's love, buy your in-laws' love, makes a difference. Is that who you're telling me is going to be leading the revolution of consciousness with all the efforts? I said, no. Every revolution in American history, every major movement came from an empowered minority. Less than 1% of African Americans supported the civil rights movement initially. Less than 1% of women voted or supported the women's rights. And even this day, we don't have an equal rights movement for women. Less than 1% supported getting out of Vietnam initially. 134 million people, we had under 600,000 people protesting. Yet we still succeeded because of the empowered minority. I said, I'm going to put my energy on the empowered minority who are awake. You try putting it into the disempowered majority and see how many centuries before you finally get the message. They're not going to move in your direction. They're zombies. You should listen to last night's show. We're out of time. Thank you, Ed. And I'm going to go over and say hello now to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Doing great. I listened to your comments yesterday on Hillary Clinton, and we sent an invitation out to have, she and you should have tea together.
I think so.
But she's going to put strychnine in your tea.
polonium, yeah. which is the going poison of the day.
Well, if that happens, I'm going to demand an autopsy. You three have a great show.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you so much.